couple of lectures on entanglement theory. And as you all probably know, this is a really vast subject. So there's a definitive review article that was written in 2009, and it's almost 100 pages long. So there's no chance of, you know, covering everything that can be said about entanglement theory. So I've had to choose a few sort of highlights and interesting facts about entanglement. I've had to leave some out. But feel free to ask lots of questions, and I think hopefully we can cover some of the interesting topics. So what I've chosen to do is to first of all say a little bit about the conceptual significance of entanglement for the foundations of quantum mechanics. So essentially, how is it implicated in our notions of what's non-classical? Most of what I'm going to say is about understanding entanglement as a resource. So as a resource for information processing, but also more abstractly as sort of what is the structure of the set of entangled states. And in the next lecture, I'm also going to say a bit about some other resource theories and how they compare to entanglement theory. Let me start with, you know, the very basics. Probably all of you have seen this before. So if we're talking about pure states of a bipartite system, and most of this lecture is going to be about pure states in a bipartite system, then it's very easy to define entangled states as those that are not product states. So a state on AB is a product state if I can find some pair of vectors, phi and chi, in the Hilbert spaces of A and B, such that psi is a tensor product of those two. And if I can't find any such vectors, then it's entangled. So the paradigm example, if I have two-level systems, two qubits, then the phi plus state, which is a maximally entangled state, is just 1 over 2, 0 tensor 0 plus 1 tensor 1. It's conventional to drop the tensor product signs. It's also conventional to drop the subscripts and just write 0, 0 in a ket. So if you haven't seen that convention before, that'll be showing up a lot. So I'm going to use that as my sort of standard example of an entangled state in a lot of what follows. All right, so the first topic I want to take you through is this famous Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen argument, which really got the ball rolling on entanglement theory. And rather than present to you the argument from the 1935 paper, I prefer Einstein's version of the argument. So Einstein, in his correspondence with Schrodinger, said, I wasn't really happy with the way the paper came out. Here's what I was really trying to say. Here's the argument. So I'm going to give you sort of my gloss on Einstein's version of this argument, and it kind of sets the issues out as, you know, what's at stake in EPR. All right, so this is the setup. You have a preparation procedure which prepares two systems, A and B. They get sent off to distant labs. And then over here in, let's call it Alice's lab, some measurement is done on the particle. And there's a choice of measurement. So this means there's a little knob, and I can choose one or another measurement and register the outcome of that measurement. And similarly, over on Bob's side, there's going to be a measurement done on the particle. There's a choice of measurement, and there's some outcome. And these are prepared, let's say, in this phi-plus maximally entangled state. So if I choose, let's say, you know, these are qubits. So I can choose one or another basis of that two-dimensional Hilbert space to measure on system A. And if I ask, you know, what happens to the state of system B as a result of that measurement? Well, initially, the reduced density operator for B is just the completely mixed state. And if I do the measurement S and I get some outcome X, then B updates to just the corresponding state SX according to this, you know, notation I've defined. And I should say that here I'm assuming that these vectors are all just real amplitude vectors. And so for real amplitude vectors, right, so if I measure a state on A whose ket is alpha 0 plus beta 1, and alpha and beta are real, then when I calculate what is the effective state on B after I get that outcome, it's just also alpha 0 plus beta 1. So for this simple example, whatever ket I get as an outcome of my measurement on A, B gets collapsed to the corresponding ket. So now if you ask, what if you don't register the outcome of the measurement on the left? So you just choose a setting, but you ignore what the outcome was. So in that case, well, if the setting was S and you got outcome 0, this would have been the state of Bob's system. The outcome was 1, this would have been the state. Those two outcomes occur with equal probability. The reason for that is that, you know, initially the state of A is just this completely mixed state as well. It has the same reduction over on A. So if I do any one of these measurements, I get equal likelihood for the two outcomes. So if I forget which outcome I got, I just have to average those two possibilities with the probabilities they occur. And so this is going to be the average state on B if the setting was S on the left. And so it's not hard to see that it's the same regardless of what the value of S was. An equal mixture of orthogonal states on a two-level system always gives the completely mixed state, regardless of which basis I'm talking about. So these two mixtures, the one where S is 0 and the one where S is 1, are exactly the same. They're the completely mixed state. And the completely mixed state is also what this state was initially on B. So if you don't register the outcome on the left, the state of system B hasn't changed at all. It was the completely mixed state. And afterwards, it's the completely mixed state, regardless of what choice of measurement was done here. And that's a good thing, because if the final state of B did depend on the choice of measurement, then you could imagine coming along, doing a measurement here, and sending signals, you know, by choosing S and registering the different statistics over here on the right, corresponding that gets revealed by those different states. You could imagine sending signals, right? So for different statistics would yield, would tell you that there was different values of S. And if you've done this experiment in such a way that these two wings are space-like separated, then relativity leads you to expect that you shouldn't be able to signal. So it's comforting that quantum mechanics says, no, if you just set the setting on the left, there's no way that you can communicate information to the other wing of the experiment. Now, I should mention that, you know, you don't have the option to control X. So even though the particular state you get is different for different values of X, you can't come along and control that. So you can't use that to signal either. The only thing you can control is S. So in these sorts of setups, there's no challenge to the relativity in the sense of sending superluminal signals. So that's not the issue with the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen experiment. It's not about superluminal signals. But it is about superluminal influences. So here's the point. This is you know, what Einstein and EPR focused on, which is that if you choose a particular setting over here and a particular basis, and you register the outcome, you get 0 or 1, then the state of system B updates in different ways. So if I get x is equal to 0, it updates to this state. If I get x equal to 1, it updates to this state. Whereas if I'd done it in some different basis, it updates to one or another of a different pair of states. So that's the what quantum theory leads us to expect. This is sometimes called the remote collapse rule for B. And the question is, should we think of that change in the state of B from the completely mixed state to these, one of these four vectors, as being a kind of influence from S or X over to system B, changing its physical state at some space-like separated region? Or should we think of it more like a kind of Bayesian updating, that ultimately the pair of particles were together initially, they act as a common cause on A and B. When I learn S and X, I can also learn something about that common cause and therefore learn something about B, and therefore this change in the quantum state could be thought of as, you know, no more objectionable than just a kind of Bayesian updating of a distant system when I learn something about another system with which it had a common cause. So that's the main issue here, which is how should we understand that remote collapse that happens for an entangled state? In this sort of way, with non-local actions, or in this sort of way, where all the actions are still local? Okay, so Einstein favored this sort of approach. So he was, you know, wedded to the notion that all the actions were local. So he wanted to say, no, we should really think of that quantum state update rule as like Bayesian updating. So here's a quote from Einstein that supports that notion. I'll just read it out to you. So the change in the psi function through observation does not correspond essentially to the change in a real matter of fact, but rather to the alteration in our knowledge of this matter of fact. So I think that's a pretty clear statement that he wanted to think of quantum states as being descriptions of incomplete information. And he believed that there were some hidden variables that might be a more complete description, but quantum states were incomplete descriptions, and so these remote state update rules were really just like Bayesian updating, you know, learning more about something that's hidden. Okay, so the key distinction then in this sort of argument is whether you should think of that these pure quantum states as being descriptions of reality directly. So the jargon in quantum foundations is, you know, is psi ontic, which is, you know, Greek for real. So in that case, you have these two different non-orthogonal quantum states, like psi 1 and psi 2, would be describing two different ways the world could be, two different states of reality. Or is it more as Einstein envisioned it, where the quantum state psi is just a state of incomplete knowledge, so it's said to be epistemic, and then two non-orthogonal quantum states are really just two different ways of having incomplete information about some deeper reality. So that's the question. And just to make it sort of easy to get a feel for how this works in the EPR experiment itself, let me just use some cartoons. So if the space of physical states is just depicted as a kind of 2D, you know, classical state space, maybe it's a phase space, then over here you're really imagining that two different quantum states are like two points in that classical state space. Whereas over here, you're imagining that two non-orthogonal quantum states are like two different distributions over that classical state space, which might in fact overlap, like this uniform distribution and this one. And so, you know, they're not corresponding to points in that space. Okay, so suppose you take the first point of view, that these quantum states are, in fact, complete descriptions of reality. Then, if I do the measurement over here with s equals 0, and I get one particular outcome, then I'm going to collapse this distance system B to one of two different physical states. All right, so these points are just meant to be a cartoon for, you know, the two different pure quantum states on B that I could collapse to for these two options are just two different ways reality could be. But if I measure this other basis, s equal to 1, then I also collapse to two different states of reality, but they're a different pair. So, you know, there's really four possible realities that could obtain over here on the right. And whether I've chosen to measure s equal to 0 or s equal to 1 determines whether the reality is one of this pair or one of this pair. And so the no signaling property tells me that if I don't know x, so I just have equal probability of one of these two, or equal probability of one of these two in this case, then those distributions are indistinguishable. There's no measurement that's going to tell them apart. But in this point of view, there's still something different going on over here on the right, that that the choice of measurement has influenced what's really happening at B. It's influenced whether it's one of these two options or one of these two options. And therefore, we have to think of it this way. We have to think that the choice of the setting and the outcome you got can have a causal influence on B, even though B is space-like separated from the measurement on A. So Einstein's point is that if you think of the quantum state as a complete description of reality, then even though there's no challenge to relativity in the sense of sending superluminal signals, you do have to acknowledge that there are superluminal influences to explain this remote collapse. But his point was that you know, in 1935, he thought you're not forced to this point of view. You have this other option of taking the quantum state to be a state of incomplete information. And so then one basis, like this red basis here, could be one way of dividing up. So now the classical state space is a state space of hidden variables. And a basis of quantum states could be a way of dividing up that state space into distributions. So the completely mixed state in this model could be the uniform distribution over the state space. And this basis could be just the distributions on the upper half and the lower half of this region. Whereas for this blue basis, it could be some other way of breaking up the hidden variable state space into two regions. So if you take that point of view, then here's how you think of this experiment. You say, well, when initially the quantum state of B is the completely mixed state, it's some distribution over that hidden variable space, maybe this uniform one. And when you choose to measure this particular variable here, s equal to 0, you update your information about the distance system. You just learn, was it in the upper half or the lower half of this region? And so you think of that quantum state update rule much as you would an update of a probability distribution. You are resolving your uncertainty about the actual physical state. Originally, you knew nothing about where it was. Now you know it's, you know, if you got the x equal to 0 outcome, you know it's somewhere here. If you got the x equal to 1 outcome, you know it's somewhere here. So the idea is that if a quantum state is incomplete information, we can think of this update rule in that sort of way. And if you do a different measurement, then you're just resolving your uncertainty in a different way. So you know, here you learned upper versus lower. Here you're learning whether it's on the left half or the right half. And all along, the physical state is just a point in that space. And your choice of what to measure hasn't influenced which point it is. All that's happened is that you've chosen to resolve your uncertainty about that point in one of two different ways based on the basis you've chosen. So that was Einstein's argument. He said this is a much this way of interpreting what's going on makes much more sense because then we don't have to acknowledge any kind of non-local influences. So he's basically imagining that there's some common cause that acts on A and B, and all that happens when you measure here is a kind of Bayesian updating of B. Okay, so in fact, if you, in you know, since then, people have looked at the kinds of measurements that were involved in the EPR argument. So EPR itself involved continuous variable degrees of freedom. But there's Bohm introduced the qubit, the spin version of it. So if you redo the EPR argument in this discrete context, the quantum information context, it's really just saying your two measurements on the left, so now I'm going to draw them in a block sphere. So I have my s equal to 0 and s equal to 1 measurements. They could be like z spin and x spin. You imagine doing the same pair of measurements over on the right. So EPR was really concerned with the fact that you could predict the outcomes of these measurements perfectly if you'd done the corresponding measurement on the other side. So if you take those as the measurements you're interested in, it's easy to show that Einstein was right. You can provide a completely local hidden variable model of that experiment, one where these are the measurements. And it's very simple. You just imagine that these two particles both have a property that corresponds to, for example, z spin, and a property that corresponds to x spin. It's not specified by the quantum state, it's specified by some hidden variables, but you imagine that it has both those properties, and that entanglement originally sets up a perfect correlation. So if this one is z up, then this one's z up as well, and if this one's x up, this one's x up as well. And if you do that, you find that you can very easily explain all the phenomenology of EPR without any non-local actions, just this sort of model of what's going on. So Einstein was essentially right about this particular experiment, that you're not forced to have non-locality. I think many times Einstein gets quoted a bit wrongly as saying, you know, quantum theory involves spooky action at a distance. So the context of those quotes is, hey, if you interpret quantum theory in the way that, you know, the Copenhagen folks want to interpret it, that the quantum state is a complete description of reality, then you have spooky action at a distance. But I would prefer to interpret it in this other way, such that we can avoid such spooky actions. And so he was right about that. For these sorts of experiments, you can certainly avoid those spooky actions. But it turns out, so 30 years later, the story became more interesting. I would say if you've heard about EPR and you think, you know, EPR tells us what's mysterious about entanglement, I would say that's mistaken, that I think you really need to move to Bell's theorem to understand what's mysterious about entanglement, because you can understand the phenomenology of EPR in the way that Einstein imagined, just in terms of local actions and hidden variables. So it's really Bell's theorem that provides a challenge to our classical intuitions. All right, so there's going to be a lecture this afternoon about Bell's theorem, so I don't want to go into too much detail, but let me just give you the punchline of Bell's theorem. And it's this, that if you move away, well, if you consider any pair of measurements in this setup where you prepare the entangled state, you can show that if this is, in fact, causally what's going on, so there are not any superluminal actions from variables on one wing to variables on the other. Then you can show that there's a constraint on the kinds of correlations you can see in any such experiment. So this is an example of such a constraint. It wasn't in Bell's original work. It's in a paper by Clauser, Horn, Shimoni, and Holt, and it's called the CHSH inequality. And these terms are really talking about the correlations for different choices of settings. So this is the case where S and T are both the zero settings, and this is the probability that X is equal to Y. So it's the probability that you see correlated outcomes when your settings are 0 and 0. And similarly, this is the probability you see correlated outcomes when they're 0 and 1, and this when they're 1 and 0. And this is the probability that you see anti-correlated outcomes when both settings are 1. These are all binary outcome measurements. So this is called the Bell inequality, and what CHSH proved is that if causally what's going on is this, then you'd expect this quantity, you know, when you average with the equal probabilities, to be less than or equal to 3/4. But what you can show is that if you take different measurements from the one that EPR considered, right, so this, say, Z spin and X spin on a qubit over on the left, and here it's spin along the Z plus X direction and spin along the Z minus X direction. If you take those kinds of measurements, then you can find that these four probabilities I wrote down here all have the value 1/2 + 1/2 √2, which is about 0.85. And so when I average them, I get about 0.85, which is greater than 3/4. So it violates this inequality. So the statistics for that sort of experiment can't be understood in the way that Einstein wanted to understand these statistics. And so what it means is that, you know, Einstein's hope of understanding the remote collapse as just a Bayesian updating relative to some hidden variables is shown to be in conflict with the assumptions that go into deriving Bell-type inequalities. One of those assumptions is this locality, and there are some other assumptions as well. And what it says is that you're going to have to give up one of those assumptions to make sense of these correlations in quantum theory. So some people think that, all right, we're going to give up locality, we're going to acknowledge that there are these superluminal causal influences, even though they don't lead to superluminal signals. That's a bit uncomfortable because there's a tension. If there are these superluminal causal influences, then why can't we use them to send superluminal signals? And others want to give up other assumptions of Bell's theorem. But the point is that when you look at the assumptions of Bell's theorem, I mean, there's always implicit assumptions that go into it. So it might be some of the implicit assumptions that you want to give up. But the point is that the assumptions of Bell's theorem are all extremely reasonable, and I would say they all hold true in classical theories. So if I imagine empirically successful classical theories, those that did not, so relativistic classical theories, those that had no non-local actions, they all satisfy the assumptions of Bell's theorem. So what it means is no matter what lesson you take from Bell's theorem, some notion of classicality has to go. And so this is why we really think in the Quantum Foundations community, we really think of Bell's theorem as kind of the gold standard of notions of non-classicality. It says, you know, no matter what option you take, whatever interpretive route you want to take, you're going to have to give up on some notion of classicality to make sense of this. Okay, and importantly, I've just said this, the violation of a Bell inequality like CHSH is really one of our best notions of non-classicality. And it only works if you have entanglement in that original state. So I showed it for the simple example with the 5+ state. But you can easily prove that if you have an unentangled state, you can't violate any Bell inequalities. So entanglement's necessary. And that might lead you to think, well, maybe we should think of non-classicality as just the presence of entanglement. So anytime we have entanglement, we should say, we definitely have something non-classical happening because we have entangled states. So although I think this notion can be useful, I would say it's going a bit too far because entanglement is necessary for Bell inequality violation, but it's not sufficient. So remember back to the EPR example. You had an entangled state. You did measurements of Z spin or X spin on one wing, Z spin or X spin on the other wing. If it was the case that, you know, whenever you have entanglement, it's non-classical, you would not have expected a simple classical explanation of that experiment. But as I said, there is a simple local hidden variable model that explains it fine. So it's not the entangled state alone that warrants you to conclude that something non-classical is happening. You have to fold in the nature of the measurements as well. So it's really only the statistics of a full experiment that could be said to be either classical-like, you know, consistent with a classical model, or not. So it's really the entangled state together with the nature of the measurements, which is better judged to be either classical or not. So I think this is a bit too simplistic a notion. And we're going to see that there's, you know, in this lecture and others, that there's a lot of quantum over classical advantages for information processing that also have entanglement as a necessary condition. But in many of those cases, it may not be sufficient. So I think this sort of conclusion applies more generally, that we should be careful not to be too quick to assume that just because there's entanglement somewhere, necessarily it has to be non-classical and there has to be some quantum advantage. Okay, so let me pause there for questions. Yes? Yes. That's right. That's right. So it's if you're talking about pure bipartite states, then it's been shown that every pure bipartite state that has some entanglement, there is a choice, you know, if you give me no restrictions on the choice of measurements, then there is a measurement that will violate a Bell inequality. So in that sense, all pure bipartite entangled states allow for Bell inequality violations. But if, I guess, the reason one should be careful is that if you know, you have a challenge in the lab for preparing entangled states, then you may also have a challenge at preparing arbitrary measurements. So you sort of, there's kind of, it's, you're sort of even-handed. It's sort of often difficult to do the measurements you want to do, just as it's difficult to prepare the states you want to prepare. So it's useful not to just think, oh, all the measurements come for free, we don't have to worry about those. You really need to consider whether you can do the necessary measurements or not. And for mixed bipartite states, the situation is a lot more complicated. So there are famous examples of bipartite mixed states called Werner states, where if you do projective measurements on the two sides, you violate no Bell inequalities. It was later shown that if you first do some filtering type measurements, then you can violate Bell inequalities with those original Werner states. Also, if I bring in a different kind of bipartite state that also doesn't violate a Bell inequality, that together with the other state might violate a Bell inequality. So the dust has kind of settled into essentially, it seems that every bipartite mixed state has some kind of non-locality in the sense that it is able to unlock a Bell inequality violation in some context. But it's a much more complicated story. Yeah. Other questions? Yes?
So back to quantic versus epistemic.
Yes? there might be. I'm sort of spelling out. I mean, the way I define them, one way of defining them, they're mutually exclusive alternatives. So the way I like to define it is if if the state of reality is encoded in the quantum state, then the quantum state is ontic. So meaning, you know, any two quantum states, if I think of them as distributions over some underlying hidden variable space, they're all sort of non-overlapping. That means if you tell me a point in that space, the quantum state's fixed uniquely. Let's call that psi ontic. And then anything else, you know, there's going to have to be some overlap, we'll call that psi epistemic. So if you define it that way, then it's really one of the two options. But you might say, I mean, the distinction as I made it really presumed this kind of framework of real physical states and my incomplete information about them is described by classical probability theory. And you could say, well, I reject that framework. And so I want to work in a broader framework where that's not how we describe experiments. And so then in that sense, you might be able to come up with other interpretive strategies. Ontistemic, there you go. Yes.
Does the violation of Bell's inequality definitively point to the ontic nature of wave function?
Good question. So I think I forgot to say it, but the nice thing about a not sufficiently appreciated fact about Bell's theorem is that it doesn't prove the correctness of this psi ontic perspective. It's just indifferent to whether you treat the quantum state as ontic or epistemic. So the Bell inequality violation shows that one of the assumptions that goes into driving Bell inequalities has to fail regardless of how you interpret the quantum state. And I think sort of the standard story gets things backwards because we already knew back in 1935 from Einstein's work that if you think the quantum state describes reality completely, then clearly there's going to have to be some non-local action. What we needed Bell's theorem for was to show that even if you interpret it as just a state of knowledge, still you're going to have to deal with non-locality. You're going to have to face a violation of one of the assumptions of the theorem. So going back to the notion that quantum states describe reality completely doesn't salvage locality. Yes?
I
Well, I think the Everett interpretation would fall into the category of sort of rejecting some of the framework that we've presumed here. So here we've presumed that there's some matter of fact about what outcome did occur on Bob's side of the experiment. Whereas in the many worlds interpretation, you'd say, no, there's different branches of the wave function and different outcomes occurred. So in fact, there is no single outcome that occurred. All the outcomes occurred. So in that sense, it doesn't really fall into this framework. But you're right that if... That's right, yeah. I mean, we could talk for 10 hours about all the assumptions of Bell's theorem and what should you say about the many worlds interpretation and what the status of psi is in there. But roughly speaking, for our purposes here, it really just doesn't fit in the framework that in which we define this psi ontic, psi epistemic distinction. Yeah. Okay, let me move on then. So this is really just a cautionary note that if you're interested in studying entanglement because you want to see whether your given setup can be explained classically or not, or whether it's intrinsically non-classical somehow, then be careful. I would say violating a Bell inequality is a much better notion of non-classicality than the mere presence of entanglement. Okay, so 1964, Bell's theorem was proven. Since then, we've had experimental demonstrations, lots of work on the quantum foundation side, but I'm going to leave this subject of the conceptual significance of entanglement behind, and I'm going to move on to the resource significance of entanglement. So, a simple storyline would be something like this, that starting in the early 90s, we started seeing information processing protocols that used entanglement. So in 91, Arthur Eckert proposed a protocol for quantum key distribution that was based on Bell inequality violations. In 92, Charlie Bennett and Stephen Wiesner came up with something called super dense coding. So there the idea is Alice and Bob have a quantum channel. Let's say they have the capability of sending just one qubit across that quantum channel. So there's a result in quantum information called Halevo's bound that says if you just have a one qubit quantum channel, the most classical, the largest amount of classical information you can send perfectly down that channel is just one classical bit. But super dense coding shows that if Alice and Bob originally share one of those phi plus states, a maximally entangled state of two qubits, then together with their one use of the quantum channel, they can actually succeed at transmitting two bits of information. So somehow it allows you to get more classical information through this quantum channel. And I'm not going to go into the details of either of these. In 93, quantum teleportation was discovered by Bennett, Brassard, Crepeau, Joseph, Perez, and Wouters. And I would say, from this point onwards, people really started thinking of entanglement more as a resource than they had previously. So this, to my mind, is sort of the defining point at which entanglement theory really became a theory about, you know, what can you use entanglement for? You know, at that point, it was sort of clear that there was lots of different uses for it. So I'm going to go over the quantum teleportation protocol to show you how entanglement features there. Okay. So here's the basic setup. Again, you have these two distant labs, Alice and Bob's. You imagine that Alice and Bob share some maximally entangled state, phi plus. And the idea is that Alice is going to be given another system, I'll call it S here, which has been prepared in some arbitrary quantum state. Here I'm going to let it be a pure state. And importantly, the identity of that quantum state is totally unknown to Alice or Bob. And the way the protocol works is that Alice is going to do a measurement on S and on her half of the entangled pair. It's going to be a four-outcome measurement because these are all qubits, so this is a four-dimensional Hilbert space here. And so she measures a complete basis of entangled states called the Bell basis. She gets an outcome. It's one of four outcomes, so it's two bits of classical information. She transmits that over to Bob, and then Bob does a unitary on his side, his half of the entangled pair. And at the end of the day, the final state of Bob's system is exactly whatever the initial state of S was, even though Alice and Bob didn't know the nature of that quantum state. Okay, so let's just go through it in detail. So here's my arbitrary quantum state. So I'll call it alpha 0 plus beta 1. Alpha and beta now can be complex. So it's any state in the block sphere, on the surface of the block sphere. The initial state of Alice and Bob is the phi plus state. Suppressed the normalization. And the first step of the protocol is to do this measurement on S and A together. So here are the four states of the Bell basis. So you can verify that these four states are orthogonal, so they do form a basis for this four-dimensional Hilbert space. And then it's very convenient to write them as poly unitaries acting on the phi plus state. So phi minus, for example, is just identity tensor, the poly z acting on the phi plus. So the poly z just does a pi phase shift of the one state versus the zero. So if I acted on the second qubit here, I pick up a minus one. So that gives me the phi minus. The psi plus state is identity tensor, the poly x. The poly x just flips in this computation basis. So it takes the zero to one and the one to zero. I get that state. And I poly y is just both the pi phase shift and the bit flip, so it gives me this state. So that's the basis you measure, and I can just write it like this, that you really have a choice of these four unitaries. You do a measurement, you find out what the joint state of these two systems are. And then if you do the calculation, the key bit is the thing that makes it straightforward to see what the collapse state for Bob is that it turns out you can rewrite a state psi tensor phi plus this way. It's just four terms where S and A, the first two systems, are in one of these Bell states, phi plus, phi minus, psi plus, or psi minus. And the B system is in psi, or the unitary sigma z acting on psi, or the poly x acting on psi, or I sigma y acting on psi, corresponding to, you know, which poly appears in that Bell basis element. So once you've realized this is true, then it's clear that if I do a measurement and I get some particular outcome, like the phi plus outcome, then I'll collapse B to psi. If I get the phi minus outcome, I collapse B to the poly Z acting on psi, and so on. So that's what happens in the second step after the measurement. You just collapse to U psi, where U is whichever unitary you discovered in this Bell basis measurement. And so finally, Alice sends two bits of information, which just tells Bob which of those four unitaries she got as the outcome of her Bell basis measurement. And so Bob can now imply the inverse of that unitary to his system. And so at the end of the day, he gets psi back. And nowhere in this protocol have Alice and Bob needed to know what the values of alpha and beta were. So they didn't need to know the identity of psi for this to work. And psi is no longer the state of system S, because the state of S and A has now, according to the collapse postulate, become whatever element of the Bell basis Alice found in her measurement. Okay, so that's the idea of teleportation, that somehow this quantum state is transferred from being applicable to system S to being applicable to system B. But the interesting thing is that usually we would think of, you know, the resources we need to transmit a pure quantum state from Alice to Bob to be a quantum channel. You know, quantum channels are the sorts of things, as Patrick was saying, where you can send quantum information from one party to another. And in this setup, Alice and Bob don't have a quantum channel. They just have this classical channel. So what teleportation shows is that if Alice and Bob share a maximally entangled state, they can use a classical channel to simulate a use of a quantum channel. So in that sense, they can overcome this restriction of not having a quantum channel if they're given entanglement. So that's the sense in which, in the quantum teleportation protocol, it's a resource. You basically get a conversion from this resource of entanglement to a resource of sending quantum information between these distant parties. So what, yes. Oh, another question. The question is there any simple experiment like the EPR experiment to visualize multi-party entanglement and not just two-party entanglement? So let me add a bit to the question, which is, you know, the EPR experiment and the Bell experiment were meant to show what it was about entanglement that perhaps defied classical explanation. So the question might be, are there experiments in the multipartite context which show that multipartite entangled states also defy classical explanation? And the answer is yes. So the most famous one is the Greenberger-Horn-Zeilinger experiment, which is a three-party experiment involving three qubits. And it's a very nice demonstration of Bell's theorem where there are no inequalities. It's just the kinds of correlations you get in the GHZ experiment always have probability 0 and 1, and you can show that those correlations can't be explained by a local hidden variable model. So that's one of the topics that would have been nice to cover, but, maybe Adrian this afternoon. You're going to cover it, Adrian? Okay, this afternoon's lecture by Adrian Kent will cover the GHZ experiment. So if you're interested, you can hear about it there. Other questions? Can you do teleportation with mixed states? Well, I'm about to talk about, you know, what would you do if you had a pure bipartite state that wasn't maximally entangled this way. And there's going to be a similar question about, you know, what do you do if it's a mixed bipartite state? So ask me again if it doesn't become clear. All right, so suppose you're just given some arbitrary bipartite pure state, not this maximally entangled state. But you want to use it as a resource for sending quantum information. So you're still interested in doing what teleportation allowed you to do, which is simulate a quantum channel. What can you do? So you might ask, how many qubits could I transmit, even though I only have classical channels, if I have some source that generates this arbitrary bipartite pure state, or this particular bipartite pure state, which is not maximally entangled? So the idea is that in this context, you know, one way to phrase this question is you say, suppose I have n copies of some state on AB called psi. So this notation just means psi tensor psi tensor psi n times. If I could convert those through some protocol to m copies of this phi plus state, the one that appeared in the teleportation protocol, then I could simulate m uses of a qubit channel with these n copies of psi. So I could quantify the, you know, amount of resourcefulness of this state psi in terms of the ratio m to n. How many copies of phi plus can I get for a given copy of psi in the limit that n goes to infinity? So imagine you have as many of these as you like. So that's that ratio, m over n, in the limit that n goes to infinity is called the rate for converting psi to phi plus, these maximally entangled states. That's right. I'm going to ask the question of, you know, what should we allow them to do in trying to do this conversion? You know, this is a, you know, a picture of what that conversion looks like, just so that we're totally clear. There's going to be these n copies of pairs of systems, A and B, so A1, B1, A2, B2, all the way up to AN, BN. So we really imagine you've got all these copies. Alice has all these systems in her lab. She can do joint operations on them if she likes, similarly with Bob. And they want to convert it into M copies of these 5-plus states. But you might say, well, you know, what should we allow them in terms of, you know, their protocol? And the natural thing is to only allow classical channels. Why? Because, you know, if I allow a quantum channel in either direction, well, then they could just make as much quantum entanglement as they like, right? They can just prepare an entangled state in their lab, send one qubit down the channel, and they can just prepare entanglement. So if entanglement is going to be a resource, it better be that what I give them in terms of operations can't be used to generate entanglement, because then entanglement becomes free. So if I give them not just classical channels in one direction, but in both directions, entanglement is still a resource. That doesn't help them prepare by itself, doesn't help them prepare entangled states. So I can give them classical channels in both directions. I can give them the capability of doing any processing, quantum processing, in their own respective laboratories on the joint set of systems. And entanglement is still a resource in that setting. So this is the paradigm of local operations and classical communication, usually called LOCC for short. And it's very simple. It just says, you know, that you can process, if you have a bipartite state, A and B, then you're allowed to process it by, you know, Alice doing some measurement on A, sending the outcome over to Bob. Bob can then choose which measurement to do based on the signal he got from Alice, get an outcome, send it back to Alice, and they can do this any number of times. So that's a general LOCC protocol. So this is what we're going to allow in their attempt to convert these N copies of Psi to M copies of Phi plus. So if you ask, well, what kind of rate can you get for this conversion, we have to be a bit careful about what we mean by that. So we don't ask for this conversion to happen exactly. We just ask that if I take my N copies of Psi, and I find an LOCC operation that gets me close to M copies of Phi plus, that's sufficient. And what do I mean by close? I mean this notion of the trace norm that Patrick was talking about. This is the trace distance between these states. So it's based on the one norm. And in the limit that N goes to infinity, this should go to zero. That's the notion of closeness, that it's only in the asymptotic limit that you expect this to go to zero. So the rate is defined as the ratio m over n such that, you know, the best LOCC, for the best LOCC protocol, so the supremum over all protocols that are part of this set of local operations classical communication of this ratio m over n. That's the rate at which you can asymptotically convert copies of Psi into copies of Phi plus. So one of the earliest results in entanglement theory was to show that that rate is actually given by the von Neumann entropy of the reduced density operator of your initial bipartite state Psi. And that's typically called the entanglement entropy of Psi. And if I have time in this lecture, I'll say something about how you get that result. Maybe it'll be left to the next lecture. So you can think of this as measuring how much of these maximally entangled states you can distill out of the state size. This is also sometimes called the distillable entanglement for this bipartite pure setting. Okay, so this is nice because it says now we're really thinking of entanglement as a resource. We can quantify, you know, how much uses of a quantum channel I can get out of an arbitrary bipartite state psi in this sort of way. But teleportation is just one sort of application of entanglement, and there are many others. And it's not always the case that this entropy of entanglement is going to quantify the degree of success you have for whichever operational task you're interested in. So for these other tasks, you may find other measures of entanglement do the job of quantifying the degree of success. And that's certainly one way to proceed, which is you can say, well, I want to find measures of entanglement which quantify the degree of success for some very specific task for which entanglement is useful. But it was soon realized that there's a more abstract approach, which is not so wedded to particular tasks, which gets at the structure of entanglement itself, I think, more clearly. And the idea is that now that we have this notion of local operations and classical communication as something which cannot generate entanglement, you can just define a measure of entanglement to be any function over these bipartite states which can't be increased by those operations. So the idea is that all that these local operations of classical communication could possibly do is reduce the degree of entanglement or leave it the same. And so now you can redefine, you know, a general measure of entanglement is to be any function that satisfies that definition. And I think that's a much more fruitful approach because it allows you to say much more about the structure of entangled states, as we're going to see. So let me give you that definition again a bit more formally. So suppose you have some function E from, now I'm going to allow these bipartite states to be mixed. So let's say this is rho AB and sigma AB. So E is just a function over all bipartite states. So it has its value in the reals. And we say it's a measure of entanglement if whenever you can convert rho to sigma by LOCC, the value of that function on rho has to be greater than or equal to the value of that function on sigma, which is just to say that this function is non-increasing under LOCC operations. And another useful way of formalizing that is just to say that, you know, the entanglement on some LOCC map acting on rho decreases the value of that function. Okay, so once you have that definition, you can now start talking about equivalence classes of states under these LOCC operations. So the most natural question is, which states can you prepare for free? You know, which, if you just give me LOCC and no resource of entanglement, what can I prepare for free? And those are the so-called separable states. So they have this form. They're a probabilistic mixture of products of states on A and B, where these can be mixed. And so the idea is this, that if we have classical communication, then Alice, you can set up shared classical randomness. So Alice, for example, could throw some dice that have different outcomes I, and the dice is weighted with pi as the weight, so she generates this random number I with a particular distribution. Then she uses her classical channel to communicate I to Bob. So now they share this random sample of I. And if they just now forget the value of I, they've got this shared randomness. So then they can follow a protocol which says, you know, if Alice sees the value I, she should prepare sigma I, and if Bob sees the value I, he should prepare omega I. And if they don't keep track of I and they just average over it, this will be the final state they get. So they're really just preparing quantum states using this classical shared randomness. This is the most general sort of state that you can generate under local operations in classical communication. And so now any state which cannot be written in that form is said to be entangled according to this definition. So this is really the definition of an entangled state for bipartite mixed states. No, the sigma I can be any set of quantum states. So, you know, whereas you heard about the Schmidt decomposition in Patrick's later lecture this morning, there is not a similar decomposition where the elements of that decomposition would themselves be states. I could write down a Schmidt decomposition, think of this mixed state as a vector in a space of operators, write down a Schmidt decomposition, but there'd be no guarantee that those vectors are themselves positive operators, and therefore they wouldn't necessarily be eligible as states to appear in that. Okay? Well, what I'm saying is that you can allow Alice and Bob to share classical randomness at the beginning because LOCC already buys them the capability of generating it. So you may as well include it. It's part of the things that you can do with LOCC. Well, the local operations are not required to be deterministic. Whether they're classical or quantum, we can allow Alice and Bob to generate randomness locally. And of course, if you're doing it quantumly, you know, one way they could generate randomness is by taking a pure state on a large system and then just focusing on the subsystem, right? So they can always do that locally in their lab, build a quantum random number generator in their lab and use that to set up their classical shared randomness if they want to. Yes? No, because I mean, the definition as I gave it incorporates the possibility of trivial measures that are, say, zero on everything. So they, strictly speaking, would be valid measures, but they're just not interesting. But the question of whether you expect the measure to decrease or not, I mean, included in LOCC would be, for example, local unitaries and no classical communication. And there you'd expect that to keep the entanglement fixed. So it really depends on which element of LOCC you're looking at. Another question. Can you teleport pure states under constraints like those that come from poly-sigma matrices? Unfortunately, I don't understand the question, so I'm going to move on. okay, so this is just the definition of entangled states. It's not easy to determine computationally whether a given state is separable or not. And there's a huge literature on that, which I'm not going to go into. But let me just get back to measures of entanglement. So this is really the defining property. And you'll note that this defining property means that these entanglement measurements are always going to be constant on LOCC equivalence classes. So what I mean by that is if rho can go to sigma by LOCC, and sigma can be converted to rho by LOCC, then I'm going to say that rho and sigma are LOCC equivalent. They're reversibly interconvertible. And if that's true, then I'm going to have E rho greater than or equal to E sigma and the opposite inequality. So they have to be equal. So that just proves they're constant on these equivalence classes. And so one of those equivalence classes is the class of separable states, which have no entanglement. And so it's a typical convention to say we can always add a constant to any measure of entanglement. So let's choose that constant such that the measure of entanglement is zero on the set of separable states. Okay. Now, again, I want to emphasize something now about what we should use entanglement for. It strikes me that this restriction to local operations and classical communications is really a very practical restriction. It's a sort of restriction which is about your technological capabilities. So if you, live in an era where quantum channels are expensive and classical channels are cheap, entanglement's really useful for you because, you have an entangled state, you can promote a classical channel to a quantum channel. If instead, you were in a world where quantum channels are cheap and you can set up as much entanglement as you want whenever you want, then you really don't care about entanglement. It's everywhere. So it's the restriction, it's the fact that classical channels are cheap and quantum channels are expensive that makes entanglement a resource in this paradigm. And I would say, fundamentally, the universe doesn't really care about classical channels. There's nothing particularly special about classical channels. Now, there may be situations where that's not true. There may be physical scenarios where you might say, the physics tells me that any transmission of information from here to here will necessarily be decohered in such a way that I should think of the connection between these two regions as instantiating a classical channel. And if that's true, then you have a sort of setting for entanglement theory being appropriate that isn't based on this practical restriction of the expensiveness of quantum channels. Patrick, do you want to add something to that? Because you look like you do. Yeah, so I think I agree with that. You could say, well, there's a puzzle here, which is that if, insofar as entanglement theory has been useful in contexts where we're talking about, say, many different regions in a condensed matter system or in quantum gravity contexts, say entanglement theory is useful, you might say, well, there's a puzzle, which is given that there were sort of no classical communications naturally in those settings, why is it that, the way we formalize entanglement as a resource, which you know, relies on classical communication, why is it that entanglement theory was seen to be useful? Is it that we really are only using that part of the theory of entanglement that is based on some other restriction, like maybe the restriction to LO without CC, or is there some slightly different resource theory? Yeah, so I agree. I think this is an interesting question. Do you agree with what I said just then? Okay, good, good. So let me just put it out there to anybody who has opinions on this. I am very puzzled by the success of entanglement theory in these contexts, given that there doesn't seem to be anything in these scenarios that corresponds to classical communication. So if anyone can somehow relieve my puzzlement, I would be very happy. Yes? Okay. Well, I'm going to talk about some specific entanglement measures in a moment, so then we can... Yes? Yes? The classical communication cost of doing a particular conversion. Well, in the case of the pure bipartite states I'm talking about, I'm going to show you in a moment that actually you can get away with just one round of classical communication from Alice to Bob. So in terms of rounds, you can get away with one round. In terms of the amount of classical information, I know there are results on this, and Patrick probably knows off the top of his head what those results are, but I couldn't tell you offhand exactly what the classical communication resources are. But people have looked at the trade-offs between different types of resource where you consider the classical communication as a resource that you actually want to quantify. The sort of plain vanilla version of this is you just say, we're not going to quantify that resource because we're going to just think of classical communication as being free and you can use it in any quantity you like. Okay, so I think deeper than measures of entanglement is the structure that the set of entangled states forms. So you have this notion of LOCC operations, which gives you an order relation among states. So, you know, rho is higher in the order than sigma if I can go from rho to sigma by these LOCC operations. So one thing you'd really like to know is necessary and sufficient conditions on rho and sigma such that this is possible. That would tell you a lot about the structure of entangled states. And so rather than talking about that in the general context, I'm going to now move to the case of bipartite pure states for the next little while where things are particularly simple. And I'm going to address that question about deterministic state conversion. Okay, so this is what we want. We now have some quantum states, psi and phi, bipartite pure states. And we want to know what are the necessary and sufficient conditions on them such that I can do the conversion. Okay, so here's just, what do I mean by this? Here's a simple example. Can I go from this phi plus maximally entangled state to this state chi, which is cos theta 0, 0 plus sine theta 1, 1 for some theta? So is there some LOCC protocol that will get me from here to here deterministically? So I definitely end in this state. So it turns out there is, and it's very simple. It starts with Alice doing a measurement on her system, transmitting the outcome over to Bob, who then does a unitary on his system. And the measurement is of a POVM. What's a POVM? Good question. So a POVM is a generalization of the notion of a projective measurement. So abstractly, so you know, normally a projective measurement would just be, you know, a set of projectors such that they're orthogonal to one another. So this is just a Kronecker delta. And if I sum up the projectors, I get identity. So a POVM is a generalization to positive operators, which I'll just denote by EK. So some set of operators that are all positive in the sense that all their eigenvalues are positive, and they sum to the identity. So over here, if you have some state rho and you measure a projective measurement, projectors are PK. This is the probability that you'll get outcome K. For a POVM, the probability of getting outcome K is given by the analogous formula, trace rho EK. And because the EKs are positive, this will always be a positive probability. And if I use this identity, I sum over the PKs, I get identity here, trace of rho is 1 because the density operator is normalized, so those probabilities sum to 1. So this, if I use this, so this is the generalized Born rule for POVMs. If I use this, I always get positive probabilities that sum to 1. But the important thing is that whatever set of positive operators you write down that have these properties, there's a way of implementing it. So the most general way of implementing a POVM, say I have a system here, I want to measure POVM on it, I can couple that system to some other system, an ancilla, and I can do a projective measurement on the pair of them, and the overall effect is to measure some set of positive operators on the original system. Good. So there are, just like with the projective measurement, I could use the standard projection postulate. I think you're asking about what's the state update rule, yes? I could use the standard projection postulate, but also, you know, even with the projective measurement, I could, upon seeing the outcome, do a unitary, for example, after, you know, the measurement's over. So the most general sort of map state update rule associated with the POVM is this type. So this is a Krauss operator of the type that Patrick talked about in when he was discussing channels. So if I just consider the getting the outcome K of some POVM on system A, all I require for the Krauss operators in the Krauss operator corresponding to that outcome is that if I take it and left multiply by its adjoint, I get the POVM element. So in particular, the square root of the POVM element is one way that the state update rule could work, or it could be the square root of the POVM element followed by a unitary. That unitary would cancel here, so any unitary is fine. So this is the most general kind of state update rule for a given POVM, and so I'm going to assume that this is what we're using. Actually, I should be careful. This is the most general state update rule for this POVM, which takes pure states to pure states. Okay, so if I allowed this thing to become mixed, then there would be other state update rules besides. But here, because we want a pure state at the end, we're only interested in these kinds of state update rules. That's right. Yeah, this is. I should have been more careful. That you know, you renormalize this to get the final state. Yeah. Okay. So that's the most general form of a state update rule for some POVM. I guess I didn't say it explicitly, but if the POVM happens on A alone, then those Krauss operators act on A alone, and I just act identity on B, and so this is the kind of action on the state over A and B. So I get a final state on A and B from this sort of rule. Okay, so that's the most general form. Now the particular one that's gonna allow us to go from here to here is this POVM. So it's just these positive operators, they're acting on a qubit, so they're in a two-dimensional Hilbert space. They're diagonal in this computation basis of 0 and 1, and they just have the values cosquared, sine squared on the diagonal. So they obviously, if I sum them, I get the identity operator. So for the Krauss operator associated with each of these, the first one I'm just going to take to be the square root of E1. So the square root of these guys just gives me this. And for the second one, it's going to be the square root of E2, followed by a unitary, which in this case is the Poliax unitary. Okay, so what happens if I choose to do that measurement on Alice's side? What happens to this phi plus state? Well, if I got the first outcome, then it's just this state update rule, M1 tensor identity, acting on that. So I plug in this, and I just get cos theta 0, 0 plus sine theta 1, 1, and I'm done. I have the state that I was looking for. So if I get the first outcome, everything's good. If I get the second outcome, then this matrix gives me a sine theta 0, 0 plus cos theta 1, 1. But then I do this poly x operation, which flips the a qubit. So I get sine theta 1, 0 plus cos theta 0, 1. And that's not the final state we were looking for. But we can fix it because Alice just sends to Bob the classical bit that tells Bob whether she got the outcome 1 or 2. And then Bob, if he sees that she got the outcome 1, he does nothing because they're already there. They've got the state they want. If he sees that she got the outcome 2, then he also does his poly x or not gate. changing this 1 to a 0 and this 0 to a 1, and leaving them with cos theta 0, 0 plus sine theta 1, 1. So in both cases, regardless of Alice's outcome, they get the final state, and so they're done. So that's a simple example of how you can do a state conversion from one bipartite pure state to another. But we really want to know the conditions, the general conditions for any two states, psi and phi, such that this conversion is possible. That'll really tell us about the structure of entangled states. And fortunately, we know the necessary and sufficient conditions. The result is known as Nielsen's theorem, and it's just this. Let rho phi and rho psi be the reduced density operator for phi or psi, and let lambda of rho be the vector of eigenvalues of rho. So you'll remember from the Schmidt decomposition that the vector of eigenvalues of either reduced density operator in a bipartite pure state are the same. So I don't need to tell you, you know, which psi the reduced density operator is on. All that matters is the spectrum of those reduced density operators. And the condition is that the spectrum of the reduced density operator phi should majorize the spectrum of the reduced density operator of psi, where this, so this symbol is the majorization relation. And if you're not familiar with that, let me remind you what it is, or tell you. So if I just consider any two vectors of probabilities, so x and y are going to be vectors of having d components, which are all positive reals that sum to 1, so this is just a probability distribution. And if I define x sub 1 with a down arrow as the largest component of x, and x sub 2 with a down arrow as the second largest component, and so on, so I'm just ordering all the components in, you know, from largest to smallest. And if I do the same thing for y, then x, the vector x is said to majorize the vector y if the largest component of x is bigger than the largest component of y, and the two biggest components of x are bigger than the two, or greater than or equal to the two biggest components of y, and so on, all the way down to the case of everything but the last. And then there's another equation which just says, because these are probability distributions, if I sum all the x's and all the y's, they're going to be equal, because they're both going to be 1. So I've just left that off. So that's the notion of majorization. And it appears here in this condition. So let me first show you how it works for that simple example that we just saw, where we took phi plus to chi. So if I calculate the reduced density operators, so over here, the reduced density operator on the B side, for example, is the mixed state. Here, it's just cos squared theta and sine squared theta as the components of 0 and 1. So these are the spectra of the reduced density operators in the two cases. And sure enough, whatever value of theta is, this is either a half-half, or it's going to be more unbalanced than a half-half. One is going to be larger than the other. And so the bigger of these two is clearly going to be larger than a half. And so this majorizes that. So this gets us back to the verdict we had before, which is that this transformation is indeed possible by LOCC. Okay. So this is an extremely powerful result, this Nielsen's theorem. And much of what I'm going to tell you in the next few slides really relies on Nielsen's theorem. So here's an example of what you can get out of it. So say you want to know, are two states LOCC equivalent? Meaning, can I go from psi to phi by LOCC and from phi back to psi by LOCC? Well, Nielsen's theorem tells us, well, then I have to have the majorization relation going in both directions. But if I have a majorization between two vectors going in both directions, then I have both inequalities, and I have to have equality all the way through. And if I have equality for all these sums, it just means equality for the two ordered vectors. So the condition is just that the spectrum of the reduced density operators in phi and psi should be the same. And that makes sense, because if you think about the Schmidt decomposition of a bipartite pure state, the only thing that I can't change by doing a local unitary on Alice and Bob is the spectrum of the reduced density operator. I can change the relative phases of the different Schmidt coefficients. I can change the basis of the Alice and Bob terms of the Schmidt decomposition. But I can't change the spectrum. So equality of spectrums is equivalence up to local unitaries. So that's the condition for LOCC equivalence. All right, I'm going to show you some other applications, but I thought, given that this is so critical for what's coming up, I should say something about how this is proven. See, I'm running out of time, but I think it's useful to see in broad outline how the proof for this works. So I'm going to do it in three steps. First step is to show that if the bipartite state psi goes to phi, then the reduced density operator on phi, the final state, can be transformed to the reduced density operator of psi, the initial state, via some probabilistic mixture of unitary operations. That's going to be the hardest step. And then the second step is to show that if this is true, then the spectrum of rho phi, so this is the vector of probabilities that appear on the diagonal, can go to the spectrum of rho psi by some probabilistic mixture of permutations. And then finally, that is true if and only if this majorization relation holds. Okay, so let's see the first step. That's the tough one. So it turns out that this very elaborate LOCC protocol, when I'm doing transformations of bipartite pure states, can reduce to this very simple one. So this is a result by Lowe and Popescu. And it basically relies, so what does the most general protocol look like? So we talked a bit about this. I just do a POVM, I use the state update rule, and then you transmit the outcome over here. Bob does a POVM, he uses his state update rule. The choice of POVM here can depend on Alice's outcome. So all these things can have a K dependence, and it goes back and forth, ping-ponging, very complicated. But what makes it simple is that if I look at a measurement on Bob's side, right, so this is the Krauss operator for his measurement, NL, it turns out that if you just write out the Schmidt decomposition of psi, you can show that there always exists some measurement on Alice's side with the same outcomes, and some set of unitaries on Bob's side, which has the same effect as the measurement on Bob's side. So I can always simulate a measurement on Bob's side by doing a measurement on Alice's side, classical communication, and a unitary on Bob's side. So that means that this very complicated protocol, all of these measurements on Bob's side can be brought over to Alice's side, and some classical communication followed by a unitary, every one of them. And that means I could collect all those unitaries together into one unitary, collect all those classical transmissions into one classical transmission, collect all the measurements into one, and just be left with this. So that's the first step. Now, what happens if psi goes to phi by LOCC? Well, one thing that has to be true is that the reduced density operator on Bob's side of psi has to go to the reduced density operator of phi, right? If psi is going to go to phi for the bipartite state, this has to be true. Okay, consider what happens right after Alice's measurement. How does she update the state of Bob's system? Well, she gets some outcome k, and for every outcome k, she collapses the bipartite state to some new state, psi k. It has a reduced density operator on Bob's side, let's call that rho kb, and it has some probability of occurring, that's pk. But as we've seen before, if I forget the outcome, so I just average all these guys, I have to get the original state back, otherwise there'd be signaling. So all those reduced density operators on Bob's side average to the reduced density operator for the initial state. Okay, and now after Alice communicates classically the outcome k, Bob's allowed to apply some unitary, vkb, right, so it depends on k, and it better be that for all these different rho k's, the unitary he does takes him to the final density operator that they're looking for, this rho phi b. Because we want this to occur deterministically. No matter what outcome Alice gets, they're supposed to generate the phi state at the end. So it better be that every one of these guys can be transformed into the appropriate reduction of the state phi. Okay, so if that's true, I can just solve for rho kb. So rho kb is obtained by the inverse of vk acting on rho phi. And now I just take this, plug it into this formula, and I find that rho psi can be written as a probabilistic mixture of unitaries acting on rho phi. And that's the first step of the proof, right? So it's interesting because here you have a question of conversion between bipartite pure states under LOCC, and this is a very different question. It's about conversion of one mixed state to another under a certain kind of channel, namely mixture of unitary. But formally, they amount to the same thing. So the second step is just that if you have two density operators and I can get from one to the other by a mixture of unitaries, then I can get from one spectrum to the other by a mixture of permutations. That's also not hard to show. So if this is true, there's some mixture of unitaries E that achieves the transformation. Now rewrite sigma and rho in their spectral decompositions. So the SKs are the eigenvectors of sigma. The lambda k's are the eigenvalues. Similarly, the rk's are the rj's are the eigenvectors of rho. These are the eigenvalues. So I know this has to be true. And now I just take the inner product with these sk's, and I find this formula that relates the spectrum of sigma to the spectrum of rho. So this allows me to define some matrix D. And this is a stochastic matrix that takes this vector of eigenvalues of rho to the vector of eigenvalues of sigma. And it's not hard to show that if you started with a mixture of unitaries, then that matrix is a doubly stochastic matrix. So not only is it the case that when I sum over k, I get 1, if I sum over j, I get 1 as well. So roughly speaking, it's the fact that this mixture of unitary preserves the trace that guarantees that this classical stochastic matrix preserves normalization. And the fact that a mixture of unitaries takes the completely mixed state to the completely mixed state tells me that this classical stochastic matrix will take the uniform distribution to the uniform distribution. And that's equivalent to this property here. And then the final step is just a very well-known result called Birkhoff's theorem, which says that every doubly stochastic matrix can be written as a probabilistic mixture of permutations. So that was step two. And then finally, this equivalence is just due to a mathematical result by Hardy, Littlewood, and Puglia. And I won't go through that except to say that if you have a very simple example, where, for example, your probability vectors just have two components, then every probabilistic mixture of permutations is just some probability for identity and some probability for swap. And so the components of y will be given in terms of the components of x as follows. So it's probability p, it's the same component. Probability 1 minus p, it's the other. And so if, for example, p is greater than a half, then you'll find that the biggest element of y is just the one that has the higher weight on the biggest element of x. And clearly, if y, the biggest element of y is defined that way, then it's going to be smaller than the biggest element of x. And in this context, that's all I need to show that x majorizes y. And the general proof just relies on the fact that mixtures of permutations can always be written as sequences of these kinds of transformations on 2D subspaces. OK, so that's how Nielsen's theorem works. I think I should wrap up. I have just a few more minutes. So let me say what this means for measures of entanglement, and then maybe we'll have time for a few more questions. So remember, this was the definition of a measure of entanglement. And now we know what the necessary and sufficient conditions for that transformation to occur are. And so can we leverage this to define interesting measures of entanglement? Well, in the literature on majorization theory, functions that increase under the majorization order. So if x is higher in the order than y, then g of x is smaller than g of y. They're called Schur concave function. And there's a whole literature on how to build up Schur concave functions. And for every one of those Schur concave functions, I can define an entanglement measure. Because if psi goes to phi, then it means that the spectrum of phi has to majorize the spectrum of psi. Therefore, for any Schur convex function, g of the spectrum of phi has to be less than or equal to g of the spectrum of psi. And so if I just define my entanglement measurement to be a Schur concave function of the spectrum, it'll have the properties I want, which is that it is never increasing under LOCC. So every Schur concave function will give me a measure of entanglement. And like I said, there's lots of ways of constructing Schur concave functions. There's a big literature on majorization theory. Let me just point out something that it might be a bit confusing, which is that the order of probability distributions on majorization goes this way. So this is the kind of least uniform distribution. This is the most uniform distribution. So you know, at the top of the order would be distributions like 1, 0, 0, 0, 0. At the bottom would be distributions like 1 over d, 1 over d, 1 over d, and so on. And what that corresponds to in entanglement theory is the opposite order, that at the top of the order, the most entangled states are the ones whose reductions have very uniform spectra. And at the bottom of the order are the ones whose reductions have very non-uniform spectra. So you know, a product state will just have probabilities 1, 0, 0, 0, 0 for its reduction, whereas a maximally entangled state will have this uniform distribution as its reduction. So the point is that the Schur-Concave functions don't respect the order. They sort of they have larger values for the ones that are lower in the order and smaller values for the ones that are higher in the order. So when I translate them over to the entanglement context, they give me good entanglement measures, meaning high values for the ones that are at the top of the order, low values for the ones at the bottom. Okay, so how do you get Schur-Concave functions? Well, here's one way, which works really nicely. Just give me any concave function on a single parameter, which can be defined in either of these standard ways. If for the vector x, you just take this symmetric function, so it's the sum over all the components of this concave function acting on that component, then you can prove that this is Schur-Concave. It's not hard to show because capital G basically inherits the concavity of G, and if x goes to y, or if x majorizes y, I know that there's some mixture of permutations, but this thing's invariant under permutations, so it's not hard to show that g of x is less than or equal to g of y in that case. All right, so this is a simple way of generating concave functions. Let's generate some. So here's a really simple concave function, minus a squared. Here's the Schur-Concave function it defines. Sum up the squares of all the components of your probability vector. So if I apply that now to the spectrum of some state reduced density operator for psi, that's just the sum of the spectral weights squared. And that can be rewritten as just trace of rho squared, right? Because this just picks out the diagonal components of rho squared, which is this. So this is just the negative of what's called the purity of the reduced density operator. So that's a measure of entanglement, the negative of the purity. Here's another example. If I start with a concave function minus a log a, then the Schur-Concave function is just the standard old Shannon entropy. And so if I plug in the spectrum for the reduction of some state, I can rewrite that as the von Neumann entropy. And so therefore, the von Neumann entropy is a measure of entanglement. And this, we've seen this already, it's just called the entanglement entropy. And you can just turn the crank for any concave function you like. Another popular one is when you start with this a to the power alpha, where alpha can be any real number except 0 and 1. The sign that you choose here depends on what range of alpha you're looking at to make sure it's concave. So I'm not going to write out the specific conditions, but you can make it concave. Here's the Schur-Concave function associated with that concave function. And then this is just sort of part of the convention of how this thing gets defined. There are certain functions that preserve Schur-Concavity, and this particular function here is called the order alpha Reni entropy. So it's an alternative to the Shannon entropy based on this Schur-Concave function here. And if I look at it for the spectrum of a reduced density operator, it just boils down to this expression for the reduction. And this thing is called the order alpha Reni entanglement. So the point is that, you know, with this Nielsen's theorem, it's clear that you can just, you know, get lots and lots of entangled measures just for every Schur-Concave function you come up with. And I think what this should make clear is that the measures of entanglement are not the important thing. It's the partial order of these entangled states that's really critical. So it's knowing how these states are all interconvertible under LACC. What does that partial order look like? That's the real essence of the structure of entanglement. And if I give you any single measure of entanglement, it just reduces to a total order. It carves this up and just says what a ranking of measures of entanglement is. And that can't capture, so if I have a dimension greater than 2 for my subsystems, it turns out that this is always a partial order. There will always be pairs of states that are not comparable, right? Phi does not go to chi by LOCC, chi does not go to phi by LOCC. Any single measure of entanglement can't tell me that. I need multiple measures if I want to see that these states are incomparable. So it's wrong to think that there's some measure of entanglement that rules them all, and we have to find it, and it will solve all our problems. No, it's really, under LOCC, the entangled states form a partial order, and the best you can hope for is a complete set of measures that reveal to you the partial order. So let me stop there, and I don't know if we have time for questions. All right, yes. If you, well, certainly there's a lot of interesting things that happen for these additive measures you're talking about. So you certainly you can find operational tasks where you can prove that the measure of entanglement that quantifies the degree of success in that task has to be an additive measure. So in that sense, the additive measures come up in certain contexts. But more generally, I would say there's no reason to impose that additivity constraint. If I have some time, I'll try to remember exactly which tasks you need additive measures for, and I'll let you know. Other questions? Yes. Well, the state has more information than you need. So as we saw from Nielsen's theorem, the only thing that's relevant about a pure bipartite state is the eigenvalues of its reduced density operator. All the other parameters in the state only take me within an LOCC equivalence class, not to new LOCC equivalence classes. So ultimately, entanglement theory says you don't care about anything except that the spectrum of the reduced density operator for these pure bipartite states. Sorry. Oh, hi.
So at the beginning you mentioned that there's a comprehensive one-year
Yes. Yeah, that's by the Horodecki family. It's a RevMod Phys article from 2009. Yes.
Thanks to humans, that would be living humans, that would be entangled.
I don't see why there couldn't be, you know, particles in you and particles in me that are entangled. The only problem is that, you know, we're macroscopic systems that undergo a lot of decoherence, so entanglement is not the kind of thing that tends to survive at a distance. But in fact, it's the idea, like you might think that, well, you know, to generate an entangled state for two particles, well, it's always going to be that those particles come together and they interact. So one of the topics I didn't have time to cover was entanglement swapping, wherein you could have, for example, an entangled pair of particles here, an entangled pair of particles here. I bring these two middle ones together, and I do a measurement of the Bell basis, and I get the two far ones entangled. So those two far particles never came together in the past, and yet I've collapsed them into an entangled state. So the means of generating entanglement are not merely, you know, local interactions between two particles, but there are more general possibilities for doing so.